At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
In the autumn of 1620, when the Atlantic winds began their slow shift towards winter, an unremarkable merchant vessel prepared to make a journey that would, in time, be elevated to near myth. Its name, the Mayflower, is now spoken of with a kind of reverence, yet in its own day, the ship was little more than a workhorse, a trader of wine, cloth, and English goods. No prophecy clung to its timbers, no grand destiny was etched into its keel. And yet, as so often happens in history, it is the ordinary instruments that carry the extraordinary moments. Welcome to History Unpacked. If you enjoy the content, consider subscribing. We post every week, and we welcome any feedback. We hope you enjoy today's episode. To understand the Mayflower story, one must return to its origins. Origins wrapped in a certain haze, for no precise record declares its construction. It likely emerged from the busy shipyard of Horwich sometime in the first decade of the 17th century, a typical English merchantman of roughly 100 to 120 feet in length. Its identification marks were common, its design unremarkable. There were hundreds of such vessels crowding the docks of London, Bristol, and Southampton. The Mayflower's distinction was not in what it was, but in what it would be asked to endure. For this was a ship built for coastal runs and short passages across the Channel, not for plunging into the vastness of the North Atlantic. Its hull was stout enough for commerce, its hold wide enough to carry casks of wine, but its decks were low, its accommodations cramped, and its rigging made for efficiency rather than comfort. The Mayflower belonged to the busy arteries of English trade, not to epic expeditions or sweeping voyages of migration. Yet, in the summer of 1620, its fate shifted. A group of English separatists, long exiled in the Dutch city of Leiden, resolved to cross the ocean in search of a quieter existence, one where their particular form of worship might be practiced without interference. To secure passage, they hired a small vessel named the Speedwell and agreed to companion it with a larger ship, the Mayflower. It was a decision both practical and prophetic. The Speedwell, as it happened, was already ill-fitted for voyage, its masts overburdened, its leaks persistent. The Mayflower, though unsuited for transatlantic crossing, was far sturdier. Still, even this combined plan faltered. In July 1620, the two ships departed to rendezvous in Southampton. There, the company gathered provisions, barrels of salted meat, sacks of grain, casks of water, simple tools, seeds, muskets, powder, and a handful of books. And then, at last, they attempted their departure towards the Western Ocean. It was a moment years in the making. But hardly had the sails caught the channel wind before the Speedwell signalled distress. Taking on water faster than expected, it was forced to limp back into port. Repairs were attempted. Twice the two ships set out, and twice they were recalled by the same wearying problem. True voyagers seemed unable to begin without their trials, as though history requires a toll. And so the company made a decision. The Speedwell would be abandoned. Its passengers, luggage stores, and hopes were packed into the already crowded Mayflower. Nearly 100 souls, men, women, and children, now occupied a ship meant for perhaps half that number. Personal belongings were cut down to the barest essentials. Space was measured in inches. Privacy ceased to exist. In September 1620, the Mayflower finally put to sea. The channel slipped behind, the coastline dwindled into a pale horizon, and the ocean open unfurled before them. But the Atlantic in autumn is a cruel tutor. At first the winds were mild, the seas forgiving, and the passengers dared to hope that fortune had relented. But the North Atlantic is a realm of moods, and the gentle breezes soon gave way to restless swells. Storms rolled out of the west with little warning. Great waves hammered the hull and sent the ship rolling from side to side with such violence that even seasoned sailors clung to rails. Below deck, the company endured conditions that strained the limits of body and spirit. The tween deck, where the passengers slept, ate, prayed, and waited, was scarcely 5 feet high. One moved by crouching, one slept in narrow bunks or on the floor, one kept always to the shadows, for there were no windows, only the dim glow of lantern swaying from its hook. And while the storms raged, the Mayflower creaked and groaned as though protesting her assignment. At one point, a main beam cracked, an injury that, had it been worse, might have ended the voyage entirely. The crew debated turning back, but among the passengers was a large iron screw, possibly from a printing press brought from Leiden. With it, and with careful bracing, the beam was secured. Sometimes a voyage survives on a solitary stroke of ingenuity. The crossing dragged on. What should have been perhaps 2 months slipped into more than 60 days. Seasickness became a constant companion. Provisions spoiled, fresh water soured, tempers frayed. Yet, through it all, the Mayflower pressed westward, driven by the steady labour of its sails and the grim determination of those aboard. The ship's course, guided by a compass, led way and a sailor's instinct, began to shift towards the colder northern latitudes. Storms had pushed them far off their intended path. Instead of nearing the mouth of the Hudson River, where their legal patent permitted settlement, the Mayflower found itself approaching the bleak, uncharted coast of New England. On the morning of November the 9th, lookouts spotted a low, rugged line of coast. After long weeks in the featureless ocean, the sight of land must have struck like a revelation. The passengers, hollow-eyed and exhausted, strained towards the narrow openings where light filtered down. The Mayflower, too, seemed to steady herself, easing in the gentle coastal waters. But danger had not passed. The shoreline was rocky, the shoals treacherous. When the captain attempted to turn south towards the Hudson, the ship encountered perilous seas and shifting sands. Reluctantly, he brought her north again, steering into the calmer embrace of Cape Cod Bay. Here, in the bay's protective arc, the Mayflower cast anchor. The decision to remain was pragmatic. Winter was fast approaching, and the damaged ship could not risk further exploration. And unlike the later mythology suggests, there was no triumphant disembarkation, no immediate surge of activity on shore. For days, the passengers remained aboard, debating, drafting agreements, and sending small parties to scout the coastline. During these early explorations, the Mayflower remained a constant presence, a floating world of wood and iron that rocked gently at anchor. She had borne them through the tempest, now she served as their refuge. As the days passed, the ship began to change character. Once a vessel of commerce, she became a temporary village, a place of births and deaths, of careful rationing, of whispered counsels and silent prayers. The weather grew colder, frost rimmed the rigging, the bay turned hard with ice, and the wind swept bitter and sharp across the deck. The Mayflower's hull, battered by storms, now endured winter's assault. Yet through it all, she remained, an aging ship, weary from her ordeal, but steadfast. In mid-December, after weeks of reconnaissance, the company chose a small harbour on the western edge of Cape Cod Bay. Here they would build. Not yet a colony, only the first outlines of a settlement. Gradually, small groups went ashore to begin construction of their first structures. But many continued to live aboard the ship throughout the winter, for the land was cold and the buildings slow to rise. The Mayflower became a shelter against the season. Fires were forbidden aboard for fear of burning the vessel, and so the cold seeped into every plank. Illness spread, many who had survived the storms now faltered under the weight of hunger, chill and exhaustion. Many died that winter. But still the ship remained, a constant creaking guardian of their hopes. Only when the spring began to stir did the ship's role come to an end. By March 1621, the surviving passengers had moved ashore. The Mayflower, her duty fulfilled, prepared for her return voyage. It was a curious detail seldom mentioned. She did not remain. She did not become a fixture of the settlement. Instead, in April, her anchor was raised and her sails unfurled once more towards the east. Her homeward passage was faster, though scarcely comfortable. With only the crew aboard, the ship rode higher in the water. The Atlantic storms, though fierce, were now familiar adversaries. After a crossing of barely a month, she entered English waters again, a ship changed by its service bearing the scars of its ordeal, yet recognized only modestly by the ports that received her. And here, the story of the Mayflower drifts into ambiguity. Merchant vessels, unless preserved with intent, tend eventually toward obscurity. The Mayflower's final years are only sparsely recorded. She returned to her routines, trading along the coast, carrying goods between English ports, and slipping quietly into the rhythms of commerce that had once defined her. She was no sacred relic, no national treasure. To her owners, she was simply a ship, useful or not, profitable or not. By 1624, mention is made that she was appraised for decay. It is likely that she was broken up soon after, her timbers sold, her nails pulled, her fittings dispersed. A ship that had carried the weight of history was, in the end, dismantled with the practicality typical of the age. Ships were valuable only so long as they could earn their keep, and yet her legacy endured. For while the Mayflower herself vanished, the memory of her voyage rooted itself deeply into historical consciousness. Over time, the story of this modest merchant vessel became something more, an emblem of perseverance, of risk, of the strange mixture of desperation and hope that propels people across oceans. But we must remember, the ship was never built for glory. She was built for trade, for the humdrum labour of ferrying goods across familiar routes. It was circumstance and the relentless uncertainty of the ocean that transformed her. When we imagine her now, we might picture as she appeared on that September morning in 1620, sails taut with wind, the decks crowded, the horizon an unbroken sweep of grey-blue vastness. There is a quiet dignity in that image, a ship unremarkable by design, bound for a journey that neither she nor her passengers could fully understand.